This is Health First with Kathy Hart, available across Canada through the National Campus and Community Radio Association.
We are back with Dr. Sanam Hafiz, and we're looking at addictions from a neuropsychologist's point of view. So welcome, Sanam.
Well, Kathy, so addiction, like almost every other disorder or mental illness, is gauged by how much it interferes with your daily functioning. So if you're the kind of person who drinks, but you're able to go to work and maintain most of your, you know, family obligations or school and your health, then maybe it's not an addiction. But if you find yourself, you know, squandering rent money, or, you know, it doesn't even have to be that severe, but if you just feel that you can't keep up with certain life responsibilities without the aid of a drug or a substance, then it's addiction. So really, you know, whereas, you know, obviously we're used to seeing some very severe forms of addiction, as a neuropsychologist, as a clinician, you have to have a keen eye, because not every addict presents the way we stereotypically think of addiction.
Mm-hmm. And what are some of the early red flags that you see before most of us would even think there's a problem?
You know, early red flags, like with anything else, would present as a sudden or an uncharacteristic change in behavior. So if you suddenly find someone, you know, missing work, let's say, always on a Monday, because let's say they had a weekend of heavy drinking or some sort of a drug abuse or a binge, that would be one of the big signs. If you find someone withdrawing from family and friends, you know, that would be a big sign. As an individual, you know, who, let's say, is spending money that they shouldn't be spending, big withdrawals, you know, clandestine activity that is, again, non-becoming of that person. So if someone has to detect it, the individual themselves will often be in denial for a long time before they call themselves an addict.
Mm-hmm.
You know, which is why when you have these support groups and someone shows up and says, you know, hi, my name is so-and-so, I'm an addict, that affirmation is important, because if you don't accept it, you can't fix it.
So acknowledging the problem is one of the first steps to actually dealing with the issue.
Critical. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
What are your thoughts on the 12-step groups? Is that a strong part, or it's only just a part of recovery?
The validity of this 12-step program is well established. There's a reason it's been around, you know, for as long as it has.
Mm-hmm.
It definitely works. There is a, you know, there are studies that have been, you know, done to assess why this it works so well. The social support that comes along with it, I think, is a big part of the draw and the efficacy of the program.
Mm-hmm.
There is a sense of belonging. There's a sense of support. There's a sense of camaraderie that goes a very long way in addiction. You know, what we know about addicts is that there's often an underlying issue, such as depression, anxiety, and so that dependence on other people who understand where you're coming from, and in a judgment-free, a more nurturing environment, it works.
Mm-hmm. Is it harder to break some addictions than others, or is addiction just addiction and it's very difficult?
A part of me wants to just say addiction is addiction and it's difficult, but let's say addiction to gambling to some degree might be easier to break than addiction to, you know, opioids, which have consumed the nation for decades now. So there are definitely some drugs that, you know, activate parts of the brain that are so relentless in the sort of the attack on the, you know, the reward centers or the pleasure centers of the brain, that it's very difficult to break out of.
Mm-hmm. So you're seeing in your time and practice, you're seeing differences in how addiction is having to be handled?
Yeah, I mean, you know, first of all, there's no such thing, just like there are no two people who are exactly the same when it comes to depression, there's no two people who are the same when it comes to addiction. You know, your genetics plays a significantly large role. there are studies that have been done to look at how genetics plays into addiction. And they find, you know, one of the ways for us to look at genetics, other than just identifying a gene, which, you know, we still have so many diseases. We have some genes, but we still don't have a clear-cut answer. We've identified some genes when it comes to addiction. But one of the most telling signs about genetics and how familial inherited traits play into addiction is that we've looked at these massive studies comparing identical twins to either siblings or fraternal twins. And with addiction, you find a much higher rate, a significantly higher rate in identical twins than you do in siblings or fraternal twins. The child of an addict is 8 times more likely to develop an addiction.
Wow.
So we know that is, I mean, those are huge numbers. And this isn't like, you know, one or two studies. These aren't flawed studies. These are studies that have been replicated and done, you know, time and time again. There is, however, the other 50%. Mm-hmm. And the other 50% are poor coping strategies, anxiety, depression, a predisposition or a tendency to cope poorly with life stressors. You know, there might be someone who's going through a divorce, loses their job, turns to alcohol and drugs, and there might be someone who's going through a divorce, loses their job, and just goes out and gets another job. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And so how do you determine what differentiates those two people with similar life circumstances? And so the answer is, partly your genetic resilience or your tendency to, you know, sort of get back up. And the other 50% is coping strategies, skills that you've learned over the years. Of course, you know, one of the largest buffer is community support, family, friends, people who are there for you.
Okay. If a child of an addict, are they likely to have the same addiction or just the same way of handling things and using whatever it takes to numb them?
The latter. You know, if it's a learned behavior, if they grew up with a parent who drank, they might pick up drinking. But addiction, so it doesn't have to be. You could have someone, you know, a parent who's addicted to alcohol and a child who's addicted to heroin. Mm-hmm. So no, it's not the same.
And as a doctor, you're saying addiction is a disease. Can you recover from it where you're not an addict, or are you always an addict but in recovery?
You know, there are different schools of thoughts about this. I personally feel that, you know, if you label someone an addict for life, then you're sort of taking away their understanding or their empowerment of knowing that they can actually overcome this. I mean, it seems like an insurmountable disease. And so, you know, if someone's been clean 15 years, you know, would I call that person an addict? I wouldn't. I would say that they have recovered and they're doing great. But there's the other school of thought that says once an addict, always an addict. And it's a way of maybe keeping them aware of their of their tendency to fall back on addiction as a coping strategy.
Mm-hmm. What kind of
I can see both sides of it.
Yeah. What kind of tools do addicts or people who have struggled with addiction have to have to carry in their tool bag to always be conscious of addiction?
Yeah, I mean, it's there's no one answer. You know, if someone has been properly assessed and diagnosed, and we can, you know, one of the things that we see is people with certain types of psychiatric illnesses, like schizophrenia, mood disorder, are more likely to abuse drugs and alcohol than people who are not. So someone who's anxious may not, you know, necessarily be prone to addiction, but someone with a mood disorder or bipolar disorder might be. So that diagnosis, that assessment, is really one of the most critical steps in overcoming addiction. Whether it's use of medication to address the underlying chemical imbalance, whether it's cognitive behavioral therapy, which works wonderfully, or programs that are designed with addiction in mind. So, you know, they kind of mimic the whole 12-step program, but they are designed for alcohol and drug rehab and detox. Mm-hmm. Then, of course, there are inpatient rehabs that have all these different levels of treatment built into it. And there are outpatient rehab, depending on how much community support you have, and can you really just sort of be trusted to be in the community, meanwhile pursuing, you know, recovery.
Uh-huh.
You know, there are very specific homes, there are sober living homes, there are, I mean, you know, obviously there are a lot of resources out there if one knows how to access them. Obviously, we've heard of people who go to these very expensive, I have patients who send their kids and spouses to $30,000 a month rehab, you know, because the insurance wouldn't pick up on it or pick up on a very small, percentage of it.
Right.
But obviously, these are very, very extensively, intricately tailored programs to address addiction.
Mm-hmm. And when we go through these processes, then detoxification and rehabilitation, do we need to be detained for those in general? Or how do you decide when somebody's not going to be able to do it in regular life?
I think one of the ways to be able to tell if someone's going to be able to cope is just the number of relapses they've had, right? It's never the first time or the second time. It's the fifth or 10th or 15th time.
Mm-hmm.
Looking at a person's ability and their resources. I mean, if someone is homeless, it's going to be just that much harder for them to pull themselves up and find, you know, a job, a place to live. It's a lot easier to just go back to what they know.
Mm-hmm. Is the thought process basically the same as the 28-day movie, like 30 days to make new habits, or has that thought changed over the years?
The thought has evolved over the years. There's a lot of, you know, investigation and studies and treatment planning that goes into this, and we realize that addictions come in such different forms and shapes, and you can't really pigeonhole people into these programs that don't work for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
They might work for people. It depends on how intensive they are. It depends on their level of commitment. It depends on, you know, the family or the people that surround them and how helpful and reinforcing they are of the treatment planning. You know, I talk about I did some work on the opioid crisis, and helped write something for the Washington Post last year. And they asked me, you know, what are some of the big factors in a family recovering? And I said, you know, sort of leaning on others for support. You know, if your license has been taken away because you were, you know, caught drinking under the influence, how are you going to make it to that support group or the doctor's appointment? You know, so if you've identified people in the community that you can lean on and say, look, I really want to get better, but I don't have anyone to drive me to this support group or to my doctor's appointment, every one person who's willing to help out will make a huge difference in the addict's recovery.
And at what point, like in the family, the whole family, there's some dysfunction around it in the addiction and how to help, and that word enabling comes up. When do you know if you're mm-hmm. helping the addict or enabling the addict?
That's a very complicated question because there's often a lot of overlap,
mm-hmm.
and especially when it's a parent or even a spouse, you know, the instinct is to help,
mm-hmm.
but sometimes you develop these dysfunctional dynamics, like you just said, where enabling sort of becomes part of the relationship. They kind of develop a savior complex, or that the addict might say, I only have you, no one cares about me, you know, I don't know what would come of me if you know, weren't for you. And so the family member, with all their good intentions, can inadvertently end up hurting the person they love. You know, whether it's allowing them to have access to a bank account, but, you know, someone, a mom doesn't want to be hated, or a wife doesn't want to be, you know, called names or incite violence towards her. They might say, oh, you know what, you can have access to the account. And what you're really doing is then allowing them to buy, you know, you can't buy drugs and alcohol if you've been cut off monetarily.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Right. Right.
Or at least you have to get very, very creative.
Mm-hmm. And as a family, if we know that somebody is really struggling, is there, you hear that other word, intervention. How and why does that one come up?
So there's some people who can do it by themselves. Interventions are not easy, you know, but if you, as a loved one, you're watching aggressive behavior, problems at work, school, health issues come up, you know, stealing money, borrowing money. And, you know, that person sort of has to either it takes a lot to confront a family member and say, hey, I think you're an addict.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't just go up to someone and confront them. You have to be able to, you have to have some kind of a game plan. But a lot of people become upset and angry and, you know, they feel violated. So they may just go and confront an addict who is mm-hmm. probably not their true self at that moment without a plan.
Mm-hmm.
And they can sometimes make things worse in some ways. So having a game plan, enlisting the help of other family members or friends, people who are trusted, can really make an intervention stick.
Okay. So now we're going to have to go to a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to talk more about addiction.